Chapter 10. 2 minutes and 200 yards later, I found the railroad track. First came the warning sign on the shoulder of the road. Two diagonal arms bolted together at 90 degrees, one marked railroad and the other marked crossing. There were red lights attached to the pole, and somewhere beyond it there would be an electric bell in a box. 20 yards farther on, the ditches either side of the road ended abruptly, and the track itself was up on a hump, gleaming faintly in the moonlight. Two parallel rails running not very level and not completely straight north and south, looking old and worn and short on maintenance. The gravel bed was lumpy and compacted and matted with weeds. I stood on a tie between the rails and looked first one way and then the other. 20 yards to the north, on the left, was the shadowy bulk of an old ruined water tower, still with a wide, soft hose like an elephant's trunk, which once must have been connected to Carter Crossing's freshwater spring, and which once must have stood ready to replenish the greedy steam locomotives that halted there. I turned a full 360 in the dark. There was absolute stillness and silence everywhere. I could smell charcoal in the night air, maybe from where the blue car had burned the trees to the north. I could smell barbecue faintly in the east, where I guessed the rest of the township was, on the wrong side of the tracks. But I could see only darkness in that direction. Just the suggestion of a hole through the woods where the road ran, and then nothing more. I turned back the way I had come, the hard road under my feet, thinking about Pi, and I saw headlights in the distance. A large car, or a small truck coming straight at me, moving slow. At one point it looked ready to make the turn into Main Street, and then it seemed to change its mind. Maybe it had picked me up in its beams. It straightened again and kept on coming. I kept on walking. It was a blunt-nosed pickup truck. It dipped and wallowed over the humps in the road. Its lights rose and fell in the mist. I could hear a low, wet burble from a worn V8 motor. It came over into the wrong lane and stopped 20 feet from me and idled. I couldn't see who was in it. Too much glare. I walked on. I wasn't about to step into the weeds, and the shoulder was narrow anyway because of the ditch on my right. So I held my course, which was going to take me close to the driver's door. The driver saw me coming, and when I was 10 feet out, he dropped his window and put his left wrist on the door and his left elbow in my path. By that point, there was enough light spill to make him out. He was a civilian, white, heavy, wearing a T-shirt with the sleeve rolled above a thick arm, covered in fur and ink. He had long hair that hadn't been washed for a week or more. 3 choices. First, stop and chat. Second, step into the weeds between the pavement and the ditch and pass him by. Third, break his arm. I chose the first option. I stopped, but I didn't chat. Not immediately, I just stood there. There was a second man in the passenger seat. Same type of a guy. Fur, ink, hair, dirt, grease. Not identical. A cousin, maybe, not a brother. Both men looked right at me with the kind of smug, low-wattage insolence some kinds of strangers get in some kinds of bars. I looked right back at them. I'm not that kind of stranger. The driver said, "Who are you, and where are you going?" I said nothing. I'm good. At saying nothing. I don't like talking. I could go the rest of my life without saying another word if I had to. The driver said, "I ask you a question." I thought, 2 questions, actually. But I said nothing. I didn't want to have to hit the guy. Not with my hands. I'm no hygiene freak, but even so, with a guy like that, I would feel the need to wash up afterward. Extensively, with good soap, especially if there was pie in my future. so I planned on kicking him instead. I saw the moves in my head. He opens his door, he steps out, he comes around the door toward me, and then he goes down, puking and retching and clutching his groin. No major difficulty. He said, "Do you speak English?" I said nothing. The guy in the passenger seat said, "Maybe he's a Mexican." The driver asked me, "Are you a Mexican?" I didn't answer. The driver said, "He don't look like a Mexican. He's too big." Which was true in a general sense, although I had heard of a guy from Mexico called Jose Calderon Torres, who had stood 7'6¼", which was more than a foot taller than me. And I remembered a Mexican guy named Jose Garces from the L.A. Olympics who had cleaned and jerked more than 420 pounds, which was probably what the two guys in the truck weighed both together. The driver asked, "Are you coming in from Callum?" "There's a risk of bad feeling between the town and the base," Garber had said. "People are always tribal when it comes right down to it. Maybe these guys had known Janice Mae Chapman. Maybe they couldn't understand why she had dated soldiers and not them. Maybe they had never looked in a mirror." I said nothing, but I didn't walk on. I didn't want the truck loose behind me, not in a lonely spot, not on a dark country road. I just stood there, looking directly at the two guys, at their faces, first one, then the other, with nothing much in my own face except frankness and skepticism and a little amusement. It's a look that usually works. It usually provokes something out of a certain type of person. It provoked the passenger first. He wound his window down and reared up through it almost all the way out to his waist, twisting and leaning so he could face me directly across the hood of the truck. He held onto the pillar with one hand and moved the other through a fast, violent arc, like he was cracking a whip or throwing something at me. He said, "We're talking to you, asshole." I said nothing. He said, "Is there a reason I don't get out of this truck and kick your butt?" I said, 206 reasons. He said, "What?" "That's how many bones you got in your body. I could break them all before you put a glove on me." Which got his buddy going. His instinct was to stick up for his friend and face down a challenge. He leaned further out his own window and said, "You think?" I said, "Often, all day long. It's a good habit to have." Which shut the guy up while he tried to piece together what I meant. He went back over our conversation in his head. His lips were moving. I said, "Let's all go about our legitimate business and leave each other alone. Where are you guys staying?" Now I was asking the questions, and they weren't answering. I said, "It looked to me like you were about to turn into Main Street. Is that your way home?" No answer. I said, "What? You're homeless?" The driver said, "We got a place." "Where?" "A mile past Main Street." "So go there. Watch TV. Drink beer. Don't worry about me." "Are you from Callum?" "No," I said. "I'm not from Callum." The two guys went quiet and kind of deflated themselves, like parade balloons, back through their windows, back into the cab, back into their seats. I heard the truck's transmission engage, and then it took off backward, fast. And then it slewed and lurched through a 180 turn, with dust coming up and tires squeal. And then it drove away and braked hard and turned into Main Street. Then it was lost to sight behind the dark bulk of the sheriff's department. I breathed out and started walking again. No damage done. "The best fights are the ones you don't have," a wise man once said to me. It was not advice I always followed, but on that occasion I was pleased to walk away with clean hands, both literally and figuratively. Then I saw another car coming toward me. It did the same thing the truck had done. It went to turn, and then it paused and straightened and headed in my direction. It was a cop car. I could tell by the shape and the size, and I could make out the silhouette of a light bar on the roof. At first, I thought it was Pellegrino out on patrol, but when the car got closer, it killed its lights, and I saw a woman behind the wheel. And Mississippi suddenly got a lot more interesting.